Dylan, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself first with your name and day job?
For sure. So first name is Dylan and last name is White. My day job is I am a licensed attorney. So that kind of encompasses everything from practicing to business development to I've been a constitutional law professor.
And then how would people on TikTok know you?
TikTok, they're going to know me more likely as Dad Chats.
Whoever invented the phrase, easy as taking candy from a baby, never met my baby. Does she look adorable in her little duck costume, waddling around? Absolutely. But underneath the yellow yarn and those fabulous feathers lies an addict, a fiend, a lollipop connoisseur.
Dylan, Dad Chats, has 1.9 million followers on TikTok. His wife, Suzanne, also known as Mom Chats, has 1.2 million. They got into TikTok on a bet with students on the high school debate team they coached in Minnesota.
And one of them looked at me and said, "You're too old for TikTok." Now, granted, these are three high school students, right? So, like, obviously, I'm a million years old in comparison to them. But I was like, all right, you know what? I'll take that bet because I'm offended that you think that I'm that old. And I said, give me 30 days, and I bet that I'll be more popular than you. And day 29, I had some random video that got, like, 17 million views, and then I surpassed them in follower count.
Dylan's TikToks are an eclectic mix of parenting stuff, First Amendment law, regular dude observations, often recorded from his car, and conversations with his followers.
To me, that's kind of the crux of the whole platform, is being able to engage with people. I think that, you know, if it just becomes a one-way form of communication where you're posting a video and then expecting people to just kind of watch it and go about their day, I don't think that's really the most effective way of establishing any sort of digital media. I think that the essence of being able to communicate on a platform like this and the biggest benefit to it is that you can go back and forth with people.
Yes, he makes some money from TikTok, but he never quit his lawyer job to do it full time. Still, the so-called TikTok ban, which President Biden signed into law on Wednesday, had him and Suzanne feeling down. After they stopped coaching debate, TikTok was their thing, their fun activity.
One of the things that was making us feel better about the idea of losing that part of our lives was that we had this other part in the TikTok creation. And for both of us, we sort of shed the identity that we had as competitive coaches and replaced it with the identity that we had as, I hate this word, but creators. And now that that is in jeopardy, aside from feeling sad, we also just like kind of felt disgusted a little bit just by the way this was done.
Attached to funding bills for foreign aid, sped through the House and Senate, and bam, it's over. Or is it? Today on the show, the TikTok ban that seemed like it would never happen is really here. What it means for creators, users, and the inevitable court battles ahead. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around. For years, someone in Washington has been trying to ban TikTok. First, it was President Trump, but his executive order met with a quick defeat in court. Then there were years of tortured negotiations about how ByteDance, TikTok's Chinese parent company, could somehow silo its American operations enough to please the U.S. government and assuage national security concerns about whether China could access user data or wield online influence campaigns. Then there were last year's televised hearings where members of Congress grilled TikTok CEO on his company's ties to China.
You are here because the American people need the truth about the threat TikTok poses to our national and personal security. We do not trust TikTok will ever embrace American values. Values for freedom, human rights, and innovation. Your platform should be banned.
Lots of congressional statements, but no action. Then suddenly, in March, the TikTok ban was attached to a larger bill providing aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. It sailed through the House, then the Senate, and President Biden signed it into law on Wednesday.
So what this bill says is that within 9 months, give or take, TikTok needs to divest from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance.
That's reporter Louise Matsakis, who covers tech and China.
The original timeline was more like 6 months, and this bill also lets the president extend that timeline slightly at their own discretion.
What would divestment even look like? TikTok is gigantic. It seems very hard to imagine a buyer.
That's a really good question. This is, you know, an app used by 170 million Americans. It has, you know, a billion users around the world. And it's not clear whether there would be a buyer who could afford a platform like that. And if TikTok only sold the US version of the app, it's not clear how that would be separated from the rest of the platform, right? Like, would you still be able to talk to users in Malaysia or in South Africa? Or would there be two versions of the app that are identical? No one really knows.
The Chinese government could also try to block divestment. China has export regulations that may cover the most valuable part of TikTok, its recommendation algorithm. And in the past, China said it would oppose a forced sale. Let's say you're someone who was solely making money from TikTok. What is the calculus now? Are you freaking out?
I think that some creators are definitely freaking out. It's a really unique platform in the sense that you can go viral randomly. I think it's one of the last places on the internet where sort of normal people can see themselves getting a lot of attention overnight. That's just not really how Instagram or YouTube works. So I think those people are definitely freaking out.
Is there any way to quantify how big the creator economy on TikTok is?
We don't really know. TikTok says that there are millions of small businesses that benefit from the platform, but obviously they're incentivized to, you know, inflate that number as much as possible. I think it's fair to say that there's at least tens of thousands of people in the US who this is their main source of income.
One of the things I find so fascinating is you have the individual who goes viral, but then you also have this infrastructure behind some of the people doing this. I wonder if you could describe that a little bit. You, for your story in Wired, you talked to some people who work in influencer marketing and are like trying to get their arms around what this new landscape might be.
Totally. So I think that some people might envision the only way you make money on TikTok is by getting a lot of views or getting a brand deal with a really big, you know, household company. But actually, TikTok has all of these smaller programs that let sort of normal people, like I talked to a stay-at-home mom in Pennsylvania, make, you know, a modest amount of money. So you can review products, for example, and get a commission of the sales. You can make what are called like user-generated content, basically ads for companies. And they're sort of like, you know, these more amateur style ads, and you can make money based on how many views those ads get. So those types of programs don't really have a one-to-one comparison on other social media platforms.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the follow-up question that someone listening might have, which is like, okay, why can't you just jump over to Instagram and make some reels?
I think you can. You know, I will say that compared to when lawmakers first started scrutinizing TikTok back in 2020, the short form video market is much bigger, right? Reels is like, you know, I think a legitimate competitor now to TikTok. YouTube has its own vertical video platform, Shorts. But I still think the way those platforms work is just fundamentally different compared to TikTok. And that makes it a lot harder to, you know, just start an account there and have exactly the same experience. Like the same kinds of content is just not going to perform the same way on different apps. And there's no way to sort of have that organic reach where you can, you know, stumble upon an audience in the same way.
Is that because of TikTok's recommendation algorithm that it, you know, is disseminating this stuff into people's For You pages?
Exactly. So because TikTok just sort of shows you this feed of content, it is able to feed people things they might not even know they want to see. Whereas Instagram is still fundamentally based on your social graph, right? You know, when you meet somebody at a party, you might ask them for their Instagram handle. You probably don't ask them for their TikTok account. It's a place where it's really driven by your interests, where these other platforms are still driven by either what you know you want to see. You know, you type in something into YouTube's search bar, or based on your social graph, meaning people you already know from real life.
When we come back, how changes in who uses TikTok might change the political effects of a ban. I think it's worth putting some of this in context in terms of how the platform has changed since we first started having conversations about the ban. You and I have talked about this, I think, years ago. How has TikTok evolved, and how has the relationship between people who make content on the platform and the platform itself changed over, say, the last 4 or 5 years?
Yeah, I have definitely been talking about this for a long time. So the first thing is that TikTok has just gotten a lot bigger in the US. So in 2021, about 21% of Americans said that they have ever used TikTok, according to the Pew Research Center. That number has now jumped to 33%. But what I think is more interesting is that the platform has also gotten older. So, you know, in 2021, only 22% of people aged 30 to 49 said that they had ever used TikTok. That number is now 39%. So, you know, this is an app that was once known for dancing teenagers and sort of being, you know, the hottest thing among tweens. But these days, it's really sort of a millennial-driven platform. And that's a pattern that we've seen with other apps over time. You know, probably people's moms and dads were not the first ones they knew in their life to get an Instagram account. But now a lot of older adults are on these platforms, and that includes TikTok.
Do you think that has changed the political power that users have?
I think it's hard to say. You know, it's always been this question mark whether or not creators are an important, you know, voter base that can influence an election. That's sort of still to be seen. You know, if they speak out, if they tell their, you know, somewhat large followings to reach out to their lawmakers or to vote a certain way, perhaps, you know, that could have political implications. But I think what is clear is that the people who are going to be impacted by this decision are not just, you know, the dancing social media influencers or the people in Los Angeles who have 5 million followers. What the platform looks like now is stay-at-home moms, you know, people who want parenting advice, you know, people who are looking for cooking recipes. It's just a much bigger, more diverse, and more mature platform than it was when, you know, the U.S. government first started scrutinizing it.
I feel like that has sort of been left out of some of these conversations, because when you hear about it on Capitol Hill, you still get the dancing teen thing.
Totally. And I think if that's the impression on Capitol Hill, it leads me to wonder whether or not lawmakers really understand the potential political implications of what they have just done, right? I remember the common wisdom in 2020 was, oh, well, teens can't vote. You know, what 19-year-old is voting, right? But 30, 40-year-olds are certainly voting.
Yeah, I guess it's an open question, right? We're in an election year. We have, what, no way of knowing whether / how this might play out?
Yeah, it's really just sort of an unprecedented situation in a lot of ways. I do think there's a possibility that the political reaction will be muted, because the reality is, for now, everything stays the same, right? The app is not going anywhere. Nothing changes. There's definitely going to be a lot of legal challenges, including by TikTok, which already said it was going to sue. So maybe people, you know, won't vote differently if the app they've, you know, come to know and love is still just on their phone.
Let's talk about that legal stuff, because TikTok has said it's going to sue. There are going to be, I assume, challenges that are based around free speech as well. Any sense of how those might shape up?
Well, if we look at some of the past legal challenges related to this issue, it doesn't look so good for the law that was just passed. So Montana tried to ban TikTok, for example, and that law was struck down on First Amendment grounds. There was a similar lawsuit about WeChat, where a group of WeChat users said, you know, getting rid of this app is, you know, an infringement on our free speech protections, and they also prevailed. I think that TikTok definitely has a good case here, but at the same time, we've seen that courts are pretty sympathetic to arguments about national security, even if they're fairly nebulous. But I think we're going to have to watch these lawsuits carefully, and this definitely isn't just a Hail Mary attempt on TikTok's part.
For years, TikTok had tried to reach some kind of compromise with the U.S. government, including an initiative to store all its U.S. user data on servers in Texas.
And TikTok's argument is, you know, no other social media platform has these kinds of protections for U.S. users, you know, and therefore we're going above and beyond, and it's okay that we're owned by a Chinese company.
What is interesting to me is that at some point, that just didn't seem to fly with lawmakers on the Hill who were holding all of these briefings about TikTok.
Yeah, it seems like this deal just basically never went anywhere. I think part of it is that it became politically untenable for the headline to be, you know, Biden makes deal with Chinese-owned social media app to stay in the U.S. So essentially, you know, it just didn't go anywhere.
You have covered tech in China for a long time. And if we actually get to the point where there is an outright ban, do you see the potential for China to retaliate against American tech companies?
I don't think that retaliation, at least in sort of the most literal sense, is very likely. And that's for two reasons. One is that the irony of banning TikTok is that there are a lot of other popular Chinese apps in the US right now. The two most prominent are Shein and Temu, which are both shopping platforms. The last time I checked, I believe that Temu has been downloaded by around 1/3 of Americans. Hmm. So while, you know, TikTok being banned would have a big impact on ByteDance, it doesn't really do anything to sort of stop the broader influence of Chinese tech companies in the US. The second thing is that the Chinese economy is not doing very well, and the government is very eager to sort of boost foreign investment and to show that the country is open for business after the really severe lockdowns that it saw during the COVID pandemic. So I think this isn't a good time for China to basically do anything that could threaten its economic security.
All of this finally happened in a matter of weeks. Is there any way to know what the next few months are going to look like, or is it going to be kind of normal for users?
I'm still kind of in shock, and I agree that this happened really quickly. It sort of feels surreal after the government was the boy who cried wolf for, you know, almost 4 years on TikTok. But yeah, I don't think we know how this is going to play out. But for users, things are going to stay the same. I think what is really going to sort of determine what happens now is how well this law and the implications of it are communicated to voters, to users, to creators, and if they really understand and digest what happened, because I think a lot of people are just sort of confused and maybe disillusioned after hearing about this for so long and nothing really changing.
Louise Matsakis, thank you so much for your reporting and for being generous with your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell, Anna Phillips, Shayna Roth, and Patrick Fort. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is Vice President of Audio for Slate, and TBD is part of the larger What Next family. If you're a fan of the show, I have a request for you. Join Slate Plus. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. It is the best way to support our work. All right, we'll be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.